Welcome to the Journey of Innovation for Mental Health and Cancer Care in the UK podcast series. Produced by the International Hospital Federation, this three-part podcast series from the Department for Business and Trade will showcase the best of British innovation in mental health and cancer care from the UK in the run-up to the IHF's World Hospital Congress in Lisbon in October. The Healthcare UK team, part of the Department for Business and Trade, works jointly with the Department for Health and Social Care and NHS England to empower UK healthcare providers to do business overseas. This final episode will cover innovative approaches to care in the community and digital health in the UK. It will showcase successful innovations and have had a positive impact in the UK and the hurdles and challenges faced along the way. And to host this episode, we have Chris Bourne, NHS Innovation and Clinical Services Specialist at Healthcare UK.
Thanks a lot, Eleanor. Thanks for the introduction. Well, welcome back to this third and last podcast in our series on NHS innovation from the National Health Service in the UK. We've been discussing innovation as a whole system. We've been discussing innovation in terms of taking research findings into practice, getting it spread across the health service. And today we're going to be talking about innovation that takes care and treatment outside the hospital walls, and really interested in mental health and in cancer, interested in, you know, what are the benefits for patients, of course, what are the benefits for staff, and indeed, what are the benefits for organizations in terms of efficiency and effectiveness as well. So really looking forward to this and to hearing from our guest speakers. I'm so excited to hear from all our guest speakers today. I think we've got a fantastic lineup again, and really look forward to hearing your views. So without any more ado, let's just do the quick introduction. So starting with Carol.
Hi, I'm Clinical and International Director from CNTW, which is Cumbria, Northumberland, Tyne and Wear Mental Health Trust. We're a large mental health trust in the north of England. We stretch from coast to coast, and we serve 1.7 million people. We've been involved in transformation and improvement of our services for a long time now, nearly 20 years, and that includes service delivery as well as particular products. And the two products that we wanted to highlight today are introduced by Ian and John in turn. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. Ian, introduce yourself, please.
I'm Professor Ian James, clinical psychologist. I work for CNTW, and I'm particular interest in older people services, and particularly in the area of dementia.
Thank you, Ian. John.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm John Bolland. I lead the specialist IPS employment support service across our trust, working alongside Ian and Carol.
So can you explain IPS very briefly?
Oh, yes. We're an evidence-based employment support service, so we help anyone who's experiencing serious mental health problems pursue their employment ambitions.
Thank you. We'll come on to more detail in a minute, I'm sure. And last, but very much not least, Vincent.
Afternoon, everyone. Vincent Tsai. I'm the Group Chief Exec and Partner at Modality Partnership. We're one of the largest NHS primary care and community care services provider, cutting across 9 regions, and with a reach to serving 7 million citizens.
Thanks, Vincent. Well, let's get on with hearing about your innovations. This is what it's about here, about innovations outside a hospital that have made a difference for patients and for staff and indeed for the organisation. So let's start with Professor Ian to start with.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about a programme we've developed called CATE, Communication Interaction Training. Now, this is a multimedia training package. It's a compendium of best practice from around the world, looking at the management and treatment of people living with dementia who are agitated or aggressive. What essentially we're doing is using non-drug interventions, because we know in this particular area, drugs can be highly problematic, have highly problematic side effects, and can reduce people's length of life. So we're looking at using communication skills of carers to de-escalate difficult situations. Perhaps a way of illustrating this may be through a small case study. It's a fictitious case study. So say we have a man, Mr. Jones. He was an ex-miner. So in terms of his life, the key things that he has is being a miner, being a good husband, and being a good grandfather. So Mr. Jones, say he retired 15 years ago. And unfortunately, just after that, his wife died. After his wife died, we discovered that he had some memory problems, which his wife had been able to hide a wee bit. So then he moved in with his granddaughter and he had a great time. He was looking after the grandkids, taking them to school, picking them up from school, helping around the house. But his as his dementia slowly progressed, he started to lose insight to having a dementia. And he also started to time shift. So he started to think he was still back at work. His wife was still alive. And this brought him into conflict and confrontations began with his daughter. To such an extent that he then had to move into a care home and his dementia was progressing. He was having some physical problems as well. And more confrontation happened. And from time to time, because he's an older person, he then had to go into an acute or a general hospital. And he had conflict there because he didn't realize where he was. He became disorientated. On occasions, he had to go into an acute assessment unit, a mental health unit, because his behaviors were so, I guess, problematic. So just in that little case study there, we can see that there are numbers of carers, both professional and family carers, interacting with Mr. Jones and having at various times having to de-escalate some of his disorientation, agitation, and aggression. And this is what Kate does. It develops a language and a set of communication skills around a framework to help staff communicate between themselves and the carers and the families and know what to do to deal with small situations, but also to deal with situations where there can be violence. The way Kate has been developed, there are four modules. The first module is we choose a magpie approach here. We'll take anything and from anyone which is effective. So we go to people like Marks and Spencer's customer care skills. We look at how you de-escalate situations in a generic kind of way, because what we believe is that if we can de-escalate things right at the beginning, you won't get this extreme behavior. So the first module is just what are the generic skills of de-escalating? So we've taken stuff from Marks and Spencer's customer care skills and the police and the armed forces.
Nice,
looking at those
nice
skills.
Comparisons.
Yeah. So that's the hub of this. We need to teach specific skills, and they would be skills about memory changes, sensory changes. And that's the second stage. We know that most of these behaviors, what we call challenging behaviors sometimes, happen around when we're providing very intimate care. And the person with dementia doesn't realize that they need help and assistance with bathing and getting washed and shaving and so forth. So we've taken best practice from around the world to look at how we do this in a non-confrontative way, giving the person living with dementia as much control as they can, because we know control is so important to us as human beings.
Can I just ask you, how is this communicated across the staff and across the informal carers as well? Is it a training pack? Is it a digital program? How does it actually work?
Yeah, so it's a multimedia package. One of the things that we're very, very keen on, and this is probably rather unique with the package, we know that staff are dealing with these issues on a daily basis. They are experts by experience, by the sheer number of times they need to interact. So we built Kate around their skill sets. One of the first things we've done is we've got them to articulate what they do well. And that's been hugely interesting, but problematic because staff are very, very good, or family members are very good at de-escalating situations, but really don't know how they've done that. So what we've done is we've spent a lot of time observing them and built on existing skills, which always is much more helpful, much more, effective when we build on existing skills. So we do that, and we may need to tweak a few things and support some of those skills through sets of animations. So Kate has 16 animations which support it. One of my interests, so within CNTW, you know, we have lots of innovative practices. That's because I've been allowed to be a clinician, a researcher, and a teacher. Mm. So we've combined all those sorts of things. And so when we see practice that's working well, then we disseminate it.
And does this work? Does it work? Have you got any evidence that it actually works for the staff and carers, but also for the individual patient?
Yeah, so we've got lots of it. First of all, we've got lots of product, and this is one of the important things. Now, we've got a really good program. We've got 60 animations. We've got lots of papers around the product. We've got a book looking at how it works and breaking it down in terms of how it works in care homes, how it works in family homes, how it works on wards. In terms of the evidence base, because I am a researcher, we're working with numbers of universities looking at what's the most effective way of delivering these things. So we've got a big project happening in Sussex. So Sussex the NHS, social services, so, and the care homes.
My question was, does it work?
Yeah. So what we've done in terms of what Sussex have done, they've got a big project which is looking at the efficacy of it. And what we found, it reduces the number of admissions, reduces medication, because we, as I said before, medication is really problematic, increases competence and confidence of staff, and the numbers of staff required on a unit or in a care home has been reduced as well. And the number of what we call one-to-ones, when people are very, very aggressive, you often have to provide one-to-one care, and we'd reduce the number of one-to-ones. Mm. Sorry, I had to explain that in quite a long way.
No, that's great. No, that's great. Thank you. No, that's so it's really been effective for the patients and for the, well, all three, for the staff and for the organization, if it's reducing the amount of one-on-one care that has to be given. That's fantastic. Thank you. I will come back to you, Ian, if we may, with one or two other questions. But John, can we just have a quick introduction to what your innovation is?
Thank you so much, Chris. Yeah. Hello, everyone. My name is John. As I said, I work in Cumbria, Northumberland Town, and we are NHS Foundation Trust, and I lead this service called the IPS service. It stands for Individual Placement and Support, and that's an acronym or an initialism, a bit like CBT. It's a way of doing a thing. So IPS is a way of supporting people to pursue paid employment, and it particularly specializes in helping people who experience serious mental illness, things like psychosis, schizophrenia, severe bipolar, mood disorders, that type of thing. We've known there's emerging evidence internationally that good employment is absolutely critical for good health. So having a job, having meaning, purpose, social interconnectedness, having an income, those things are critical to not only having good health, but reducing things like health inequalities, comorbidities, things that make people poorly. So we know that there's a wealth of evidence that having a good job is important. Unfortunately, for people who have severe and enduring health problems, particularly mental health problems, the recruitment system often isn't tailored to their needs. So particularly, there's much discussion in recruitment these days about equality, diversity, and inclusion. How can we make recruitment practices more inclusive? The reality is that that can be very, very challenging to do, catering to individual needs when you're trying to take a whole system approach. Perhaps think about the speed of processing applicants, the speed of interviewing applicants, the speed of onboarding applicants. Those things can be...
So do you give special support somehow to people with mental health problems then?
We absolutely do, Chris, yes. So basically, we set up in 2019 from nothing. So there was no service, and we're now the largest service in the UK. And what we do is we build an individualistic service. So we tailor what we do to each person we meet. We carry out a strengths-based assessment of what they would like to do, their needs, their wishes, their ambitions. We then take that beyond the hospital walls, outside of the NHS, into communities, and we meet businesses. And we do exactly the same thing with businesses. We find out what's the business's needs. So we try and act as a matchmaker, clinical matchmaker, between someone with serious mental health problems and a business that would like...
Give me an example of some sort of radical example of what you've done to support the two to match, as it were, for it to work for both sets of people.
Absolutely. We actually practice what we preach. So I've got a team of 50 staff who work across the trust. And of that 50, a proportion are people who've come through our service. So we started to adapt the way that we carry out recruitment. We write to people with the interview questions. So when we shortlist based on values, a person's values, how they communicate about themselves. And then we tell them what we're going to ask them, because we want them to come with the most useful information.
If I may, I mean, one of the issues here is that you can place someone and it appears to be the right match. But then there are issues as going forward. Someone may have a little bit of a minor relapse or whatever.
Yeah.
Do you help manage that side of it as well?
Absolutely. So we stay involved with both the new employee and the employer for as long as both of them would like. And often what we find is that employers feel very at sea with mental health, particularly serious mental health, but certainly with mild to moderate mental health as well. So the offer here is taking the expertise, the clinical expertise within the NHS, and taking it out into the community, into businesses. So in that example, Chris, we would help support the line manager, the HR manager, and the employee themselves to understand what might be prompting this anxiety, which adjustments could we make in the workplace right now. And we'll physically go into the workplace. So this reduces occupational health assessment costs. It's great for both the employee, because they continue the continuity of care from the NHS, but also the employer gets this for free. They're getting a great member of staff, an employment specialist from our service, and they can take the knowledge that they've accrued from working with us and apply it to their whole workforce if they'd like.
So same question to you. Does it work?
It does work. So there's multiple randomized controlled trials across the world into IBS. So this is particularly, there are other organizations doing this in the likes of Australia and America. We're twice as effective as the next best method of helping people with mental health problems, not only attain employment, but sustain it. So of everyone we help, about 65% choose to stay in employment beyond 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. And really, our goal, Chris, is to democratize access to this. And if I do my job right, we're not going to need this service in 10 years' time, because the recruitment world will have changed and employers will feel much more confident and comfortable supporting all of the workforce with mental health.
Excellent. Excellent ambition. Thank you. That's, don't want to put you out of a job, but that sounds a good reason to, for that to happen. Great. Well, two really interesting, contrasting and interesting innovations from north of England. So thank you very much. We'll come back to some further questions about how it all went. So, but I'm going to now turn for something a little bit different, or maybe not. It's going to be primary care. So Vincent, tell us about a couple of your innovations.
Yeah, no, thank you. And congratulations, Ian and John and Carol. You guys look like you're doing really fantastic stuff. So we come from a very different vantage point. So we're primary care, but we know we are just a microcosm of the broader system. So we have always looked forward and ahead in collaborating more with other colleagues, because you know, without the system, everything breaks, right? I don't know. We don't really call it innovations. We kind of just do it, if you know what I'm saying, because we are under so much pressure in primary care. And actually, I would argue the whole system. We just need to work more together to address the crippling demand and the lack of capacity. So we have teamed up with secondary care colleagues, you know, across now 20 specialties, where GPs with specialist interests providing outpatient services, elective care, but teamed up with a hospital consultant. So this gives a chance for everyone to work at the top of their license. It brings a different pool of resources that may not have existed. And it's been phenomenally helpful in recruiting and retention, because the new generation of clinicians wants a portfolio. They don't want just to be a GP. They want to be a GP with some specialism. So we've had incredible support and impact in terms of reducing the backlog, which seems never ending. But we've done that really well. And the other
That's
thing
the with backlog done, too, see, to, for a hospital appointment or a hospital operation.
That's correct. Yeah. So the other thing we have also done to augment, because we bring a primary care lens to it too, is how can we deliver more personalized care upstream? And I think we don't do that enough, but we did a lot of data analysis to figure out segments of the population who needs different kinds of care. So there's people who need transactional care, you know, a quick phone call addresses it, you know, a quick online request, versus those who really need continuity. So we found segments of the population where they really need a different level of attention. Now, we don't have enough doctors around, or yeah, we don't, but we've been able to build a team. So in one particular example, say diabetes, by the way, you know, weight, hypertension, that they all are like the same root cause of many evils. So we built a small team of coaches. So they're supervised by the GP, and we can actually give a lot more time to these patients to change their behaviors and to lead a healthier lifestyle. We are actually promoting demedicalization. So less medicine sometimes is good, right? So we're saying help eat better, get more active, sleep better. And actually we've had phenomenal results there too, where for the cohort of patients we've been supporting, we've seen signs of people reversing their type 2 diabetes. And we believe it's through these kind of work upstream that we can avoid all the massive complications and costs downstream. We are right now very reactive and we're trying to push that. And then one last thing, just to bring tie it all together, we won't have anything without our workforce. So we have actually invested in bots where we are automating the really mundane clinical administration. So at Modality, we have 80,000 documents that we receive every month. And I think a third of them are on paper still. Now, that is so destroying, right? Having to take up clinicians' time looking at each piece of paper that comes through. So we have, again, doing it very carefully with the right clinical governance. We've now programmed our own bots where it can read different document types, just to reduce that burden on team members. Now, we've not made anyone redundant doing this thing, so it isn't about money. We just wanted to improve the working day of the team. And so that, you know, you see the combination of things that we are cracking on with, just trying, has all made its own difference and impact. And so that's the kind of innovation we've been working on.
That's fantastic, Vincent. Some fantastic examples there. Thank you. And it sounds as though you're very driven by data and digital systems. I mean, underpinning all that clinical work and coaching work that you do. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, look, digital is here to stay and we need to embrace and apply it correctly. I've seen bad things happen with the adoption of digital health. I think it has actually exacerbated inequalities. You know, there are people with no access or are not well geared up to do that. So we just need to be balanced. We need to ensure we're getting the best parts of digital. Look at what we're doing now. Yeah, we're in different parts of the country and we can do a podcast. Brilliant. But what is the right balance? I think we need to make sure patients' preferences are respected the best we can, augment it with digital. So sometimes it's just the basics. So in Hull, where we have a fair bit of Eastern European patients from Eastern European countries, they would never want to use an app, never. So what we do is we have, you know, folks, we hire folks who can speak their native tongue and we just open up a line and there's queues of people aren't getting their questions answered. You know, there's still the basics way of engaging with communities and people.
And that's really important, isn't it? But I think what's interesting as well, that you do have this digital underpinning, both for your bots, so the automation of the administrative work, but also the segmentation you talked about at the beginning, that so you can work out which patients need what sort of help. I think that's really important and effective and efficient. Can I just ask you about your first example about the GPs with, I think we call them GPs with special interests. I mean, some people say, well, you know, they're never as good as a consultant. I mean, do they actually get as good result as the consultant themselves might?
Yeah, look, I think it's about working as a team. So consultants are trained to an extreme degree to deal with very complex cases, right? You know, it's just like GP seeing a patient who have a cold. It's not the right use of their skill set and what they're trained for. So what we have here is different grades of sophistication and experience. So when you have a lot of patients coming through, we're not using the top skill sets of the consultants correctly. So that's, you know, that then reduces the capacity of the consultants who can be the theaters and doing other things. So it's about allowing different people a chance to progress and work at the top of their license. So in the case of the GPs, the chance to become having a specialism and learning and dealing with a different level of environment and complexity, but then relieving the pretty simple in the consultant's mind cases that they're probably like, hang on, this is not the right use of my time. So I think it's about helping each other work to the top of their game. So I think it's not so much whether someone's better than the other. I believe a GP with specialist interest has the right skill set to be equally effective for the cases that they're seeing. And for those that we can't handle, we hand it back. And actually post-COVID, we've noticed we had to pass more cases back to the consultant because people have come so late in the journey, you know, that we can't even help as much as we could have otherwise. So we need to get...
What difference does it actually make, do you think? What have been the results so far of this approach?
Well, I think the extra capacity has improved access. We've been able to be the frontline triage or on referrals. We've reduced the backlog. There's significant waits in different trusts, different specialties under pressure for various reasons. We've been mucking in, reduced the backlog. And it's a good thing because the earlier you get to people, the better, right? And that's the challenge we have as a nation right now. But we're chipping away at it. And it's been proving to be very positive. And the GPs with the specialist interests are happy. The consultants are happy.
You talked about some of the challenges, including workforce challenges you've met. I mean, what have been the most difficult things to overcome? How have you approached those to achieve your, what you're not calling innovations, you're calling, well, I'll call them innovations or improvements to the service?
Yeah, I think at the heart of it is people, right? So we have people serving others. I think the thing I've been trying to work on within Modality is to make sure everyone feels their value. Everyone feels that all their hard work is actually recognized, because right now it feels like you just expected to do more with less. So I think we're bringing the softer side of it to say, you know, you're doing great. And, you know, it is okay to feel tired. It is okay to feel sad that, you know, you got lots going on. So I think it's bring the human side of it to our teams again, I think, because we're just running and running forever and it's never ending. So I think it's about bring that. And when people feel their value and they can go that extra mile.
That's a really important reminder, isn't it? It's not just about technology and techniques. It's about people. That's great. Well, I'll come back to you in a minute, Vincent. Thanks very much. So back to you, if I may. I mean, what was critical to making your approach, your innovation happen? What was it within the trust or within the wider health and care community, if I can call them that, that made it, that gave you encouragement, made the innovation happen?
Well, I guess one of the issue is that, you know, it's the need. If you look at the population, so one in 67 people in the UK have a dementia. It's a huge number. Mm. So in the course of a dementia, we're all going to get agitated and potentially aggressive. So there's a huge need. What was happening at the time when I first started working in the field is we didn't have any really good models. We didn't really have any good frameworks. And I think what we've been able to introduce is some very helpful frameworks, the extent that now the British Psychological Society new guidelines are based on the work we've done. So there
That's
was
really
a huge
interesting,
need.
Isn't it? So you've actually created the model that the national organizations have then picked up.
Well, one of the other big things, the driver personally, was the most recent 2018 NICE guidelines.
Which, that's our National Institute for Clinical Excellence.
Yeah, which essentially said, and this is across the world, we should not be using medication as a first-line treatment in this area. And then they give a lot of guidelines about the medication, but very little guidelines, helpful guidelines about what to do. We put everybody in a very difficult situation. And so what we've tried to do is plug that gap. This is what you need to do.
So is your organization permissive that it lets someone like you get on and do stuff, or is it more supportive, or are there other people that have been important in making all this happen?
No one does it by themselves. So I'm linked into universities and some great people. I mean, I guess we've got a good pedigree in our trust, and they've been very supportive, and they've built the program, you know, and I think in any good program, what you need is a good product. You need to go, certainly an online product, the technicality, you know, working in care homes. We had a project, another university, a big randomized controlled trial, and the problems, the technical problems about getting Wi-Fi into care homes, getting people to be able to use them, because, you know, some of them are old houses with walls, you know, numbers of feet thick. So all that had to be done. And I guess that's where it's been really, really helpful. And the other big helpful thing for us has been the buy-in from trusts and other organizations, training organizations around the country, which have helped disseminate the product. Obviously, they found it value, but they've also been very, very helpful in demonstrating its use in the various settings.
So those sorts of partnerships with universities and other organizations.
Yeah.
And we've been doing some work
in India as well with Cadabans, and that's been helpful looking at, because we've produced the animations. Animations are fantastic because obviously we can just change the language very, very easily, and they can be used in many, very different countries just by. And the other thing, which is really important, we've got full control of the package. We did a big study previously where we had to buy in the expertise about creating the product, and then we couldn't afford to change the product once we'd created it. Because CNTW owns the package, we're in the middle of changing it and developing and adding to it as studies come forward.
That's a really interesting lesson, isn't it? Yes, and thanks for the reminder that your trust is, you're already working with overseas colleagues, India, the Cadabans mental health services there. John, can I turn to you? So again, what would you say? Who are the key sort of partners, the key supports to getting your service set up and running?
Our trust were instrumental, Chris, in supporting this. So they gave us a lot of autonomy to set this up from scratch, and it was a large undertaking. But we also partner nationally, so we work with other trusts and third sector providers who this was recommended by NICE to be rolled out by the National Institute of Clinical Excellence to be rolled out across the country, particularly for the treatment of psychosis. So we work very closely nationally. But IPS, this type of employment support, is an international field, so we're also contributing to the international research. With us being the largest provider in the UK, We support yearly fidelity reviews, which is independent evaluation of services. And we're really excited and keen to remain closely involved in that, where we open our service up to independent inspectors. They come in, they meet people who are using our service, they meet our clinicians, and they look at our data.
That really completes the circle, doesn't it? The research turned into practice, turned into then evaluation and audit at the end of it. And
absolutely,
then you learn again. That's a fantastic circle, isn't it? Sorry, John, you had another
question. I was just going to say, Chris, the other element is business. It's a huge part of this. So obviously, we support our service users, but really the businesses are the third major audience here. So working with businesses to understand their needs, to think about recruitment and retention of staff and maintaining the health and well-being, because what is in a business interest is to be able to recruit and retain those staff. But it's also in our health services interests, because we want to prevent people from becoming unwell in employment.
So did you work with employers' organisations at all locally?
Yeah, and really this COVID, as horrendous as it's been for the world, has really accelerated these conversations, because it rapidly put mental health on the map for all businesses internationally. So whereas before, Chris, we would go into a large employer and they'd be a little surprised or bemused as to why the NHS was on their doorstep. Now they really welcome us. They're keen to have these conversations, that they'd like to understand how to think and promote good health in the workplace.
That's excellent. Carol, I don't know if you can make a comment here, because you're in charge of all the innovation in your hospital and your mental health trust, aren't you?
No, I'm just a bit player, that's all.
Oh, that's cool.
It's a wonderful team to work with, Chris. I mean, I think the partner that we all perhaps are missing, not following Vincent's lead, is the missing partner is in fact IT. And I think there's a very interesting piece of work that particularly John is doing. I mean, Ian is able to describe clearly the rather sophisticated IT that's working. But John is starting to use IT in terms of ChatGPT about producing documents for people who could do with some assistance. And it'd be very interesting to compare notes with Vincent at some point about that.
The bots, learn about the bots. Well, let's bring Vincent in here. Vincent, you're a big organization anyway, and across many different GP practices and other parts of the organization. But who have been the key people for you that have supported you and Medallis in this journey of producing new things all the time, new approaches to care and new approaches to administration as well?
Proud to say that over the years, we've actually embedded it in our culture. I think we have partners who joins Modality are the kind of people who wants to try new things and not being afraid of sort of getting it wrong. You know, I obviously have the privilege of being the decision maker for many things, right? So, but I've also, you know, like what has been said is we do as a team, you know, the
idea. Have you had to persuade people outside Modality? You're a bit of a trailblazer as Modality, which brings together all these primary care services. Or have you found there actually has been a lot of support from other organizations like Academic Health Science Networks, the NHS has, for example, or other innovation, you know, agencies, if I can call them that?
We work in a very complicated system, right, to say the least. So our approach is to focus on where the positive energy is. And we do things that is within our gift. And so we work very closely with NHS England. We consult with colleagues just to find the win-win together. But there are times where, you know, because of the architecture or the history of how things are set up, things can't change as easily. But this is where Modality comes in, because we will say, hang on, we think that's not quite right, but maybe over time it could change. So let us invest, let us get it going and prove it out to people. You know, so that's how we work. But, you know, again, I know we are fairly large compared to many general practice colleagues, but we're still just us in the context of the NHS approach and the ethos of it. But the difference is we have the playground. You know, we have enough people who are willing to say yes and try. And so it's a mindset of willing to have a go at things. I think that's the biggest difference.
Well, that's been great. It's been really fascinating talking to you all. Thank you so much. I mean, it just emphasizes the importance of the innovation culture and system within your organizations, as well as the support from outside. So I think that's a really good lesson, if you like, or suggestion. I'm sure other people will feel the same listening to this from the different healthcare operators across the world. So thank you so much for giving those. That's really interesting. We're talking about organizations. Nevertheless, we're talking about services that are actually delivered outside the organization in communities. So that's really important to understand that. So thank you so much. It's been really interesting to hear about that. I'm just going to ask you now to say more or less goodbye and any last comments. So Ian, starting with you.
Well, thanks very much for giving us the opportunity to talk about this. I'm very passionate about older people. and people living with dementia. And I'd be very happy to speak to people and inform them more about the services we provide. So thank you again.
Thank you, Ian. John.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be able to speak on the podcast. And yes, if people would like to contact us at all, we are hoping to be the European world leaders in IPS. So very keen to talk about this with other practitioners. Thanks again, Chris.
Thank you. Carol.
Thank you very much for having us. We've highlighted some very serious areas of mental illness, the serious end and employment, and particularly dementia, which is becoming something that people are more and more aware of. Thank you very much for the opportunity, and it's been very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks, Carol. Vincent.
Thank you again, Chris, and everyone for the opportunity. I can't think of a more important time in history where health systems and leaders need to come together and solve for common challenges. And I think these podcasts and the upcoming Congress event are great opportunities where people can showcase and share things. And I look forward to continue to learn. Really nice to meet you guys today.
Thanks very much, Vincent. And thanks for introducing the World Hospital Congress with Healthcare UK, which I work with in the Department for Business and Trade. We'll be there and present in the Congress, and along with some of our colleagues from the NHS and healthcare companies. So we very much look forward to following up the conversations we've started on these podcasts at the event. And with that, I will say goodbye and hand over to Eleanor.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode and our series overall. Healthcare UK, part of the Department for Business and Trade, are running the symposium Bridging the Mental Healthcare Gap: Lessons for Hospital and Healthcare Leaders, and the roundtable discussion, How Innovations in Early Diagnostics and Intervention Solutions are being implemented into the NHS and improving the efficiency of cancer care in the UK at the World Hospital Congress. For more information, visit www.worldhospitalcongress.org. Bye!